Hi, this is John Hamel again, and I'm going to be doing part two of my conversation with Erica Lawrence on the ACT approach to better intervention treatment. Today, in this episode, we're going to talk about clinical implications of research on ACT and better intervention. So, welcome back to the podcast, Erica, and let's go ahead and resume our conversation from our last episode. So we were talking about how you can't superimpose the ACT approach directly as is, as it's been used with other types of problems such as anxiety, directly to better intervention. So talk about how you've adapted ACT for working in particular with a population of mandated court referred clients.
I think there are a couple of different ways that we've done that, and we're still definitely using ACT, but there's an increased emphasis on what others say and do. So, for example, with traditional ACT or the way it's been used in some of the other contexts I mentioned, the focus is on unwanted internal experiences, such as thoughts and feelings. We also spend quite a bit of time talking about unwanted words and actions from others. So, for example, in the middle of an argument with one's partner, we might talk about one's willingness to hear what their partner is saying, or sit with the fact that their partner may be yelling at them, as well as being willing to experience the anger and the hostile thoughts that come up in that context. So that's one piece where we emphasize something that's not always emphasized. The second is that we spend much more time on urges, and particularly aggressive urges. Now, urges are certainly part of ACT. Within those internal experiences, but I think mo in more context, the focus has been on the thoughts and feelings. And so we spend a lot of time helping people learn to notice and allow their urges, particularly any aggressive urges, and then not act on them, of course. The third is, as I mentioned, really adapting concept by concept, session by session, technique by technique. Pairing ACT with everything we know about IPV. So all of the examples and we have several sessions that are specifically focused on IPV contact, but they're still presented, the material is still presented in an ACT consistent way.
It sounds somewhat like the approach I've been using for a long time with the anger management component of my program. Before I had even heard of ACT, I was quite aware of studies looking at how anger works, and some of the common beliefs about anger that, in particular, the idea that you can ventilate, that you can let anger out, that as though it's something inside of you that, like steam, that needs to be let out, and that kind of thinking actually can make things worse. So I, over the years, I've been teaching my clients in our batter intervention programs here in the San Francisco Bay Area that anger is an emotion, and that there's no steam. It's a state of mind more than anything else. One of the things I tell the clients is that no one's ever actually exploded, as a result of being angry. People use that kind of language. People say, I feel like exploding, and people say things like, I was just, feeling all this steam, or I was hot under the collar, and I so over the years, just knowing something about research on anger and how it works, I used that research with my clients to kind of bring home the point that anger is not something to fear. It's an emotion, and to try to get them to look at it differently, the concept that I use is that anger, instead of thinking of it like a pressure cooker that will blow up, think of it as a smoke alarm that gives you information. Now,
Thank you
when
for
I
putting us here for a podcast on your work.
well, so I wanted to then ask you, what are some of the conceptual tools that you use? You might use something like I do, or something else to get clients to kind of stop reifying anger as something real that's some kind of bad thing that needs to gotten rid of, and think of it more like a state of mind or product of dysfunctional thinking.
Well, if I may, I think I might answer that a little differently because I think that's one piece of what we do. But maybe I could talk to you about what's different about active from
Okay.
existing approaches. So one, and I think this touches on some of what you were saying, is that we've really incorporated multiple contributors to intimate partner violence rather than sort of a one size fits all, which I think historically has been used. So we do talk about, as is incorporated into Duluth, power and control and dominance and submission and societal contributions, the role of sexist beliefs and beliefs about gender roles. We also incorporate some of the key pieces of a CBT, the CBT groups, which incorporate anger management and hostile attributions, for example. We also include a discussion about the role, potential role of alcohol and drugs in a given context, family of origin experiences, the current romantic relationship, not blaming the victim, of course, but considering that context. Traits such as that are relevant, such as impulsivity, jealousy, hostility, mistrust. And so the idea is we even have a session called Contributors to How I Got Here. And so we introduce these different contributors and we end it with the person starting to develop their own narrative and their own understanding of the contributors to how they got there. The idea is that that evolves over time. And also we then move into what are the pieces you can and cannot change or can and cannot control. We can't change our family of origin, for example, but there are other pieces we can control. And so I think we talk about some of the things that you were just talking about, and we talk about some of the pieces that are in Duluth and in CBT and really try to make it multidimensional so that it's relevant to each person who comes into group. So that's one way that I think it's different. The second way, as we talked about earlier, was that it's collaborative, not confrontational. And again, fewer and fewer groups are confrontational these days, but traditionally they were.
Right.
We'd use a lot of discussion, experiential work, activities, metaphors. There's very little didactic work. We use more of a Socratic method, if you will, of asking people what they think and not. So that it sort of makes it harder for them to tell you what they think the right answer is or what they think you want to hear. So that's one. The third, as we talked about earlier, was using an intrinsic instead of extrinsic motivation to change. And the fourth, as we talked about, is that different approach to targeting thoughts and feelings. So being willing to experience them and then make behavioral choices rather than seeing the thoughts and feelings needing to change in order to change the behavior, which is how some of them think about it. They
Right,
sort of
right.
see themselves on, as if it's this automatic, this person, this happens, and then I behave this way, and there's no space in there. And so we really break down that space in there and have them practice over and over with incidents in their own lives, noticing the internal experience, telling us what happened, noticing the internal experiences, pausing. Being mindful, thinking about the values that are relevant to that moment, and then making a behavioral choice and just slowing that down over and over until they start to really do it, and that becomes the norm for them.
Do you have worksheets that you use to help clients do th go through this process?
Yes, I mean, it depends on the session. We have worksheets for most of the sessions, depending on the skill we're teaching. And typically, what we do is we start out any session with more of a general discussion. With a more of a neutral tone, what are some ways that people try to avoid feelings of anxiety? And so we'll write them all on the board and it'll be a big group discussion. And then over the course of the session, we'll then move towards their own personal experiences and what are their away moves, if you will. And so they will fill out a worksheet that's relevant to their own experiences.
So let's backtrack just a little bit. I want to get a sense of what your program looks like. Is there a specified number of weeks? How long or how many hours per week? And do you have a manual or do you just have handouts? Is there a specific topic for each week or does it vary depending on the client population?
I can answer all those.
Okay.
So we developed it to fit the mold of what's being done in states right now. So it's 24 weeks because that's what most states mandate. Now, people could stay in it for more than 24 weeks. Some states, you know, mandate longer than that, 36, for example. And they're, if you go straight through, they're 90-minute sessions. Again, we were trying to match it to the interventions that were being done for the best comparison. Some people do 2 hours with a break or collecting money or doing attendance at the beginning. But the content itself is about 90 minutes. It's designed to be done in groups. We also set it up so that the groups are open, which means that participants can join at any time, which is a really different way of creating an intervention. I think traditionally we think of interventions as, you know, you start in session one and you go through. And we had to create something so that people could come in at any time and still get the same benefits and still catch on to where things were. And there are a number of different ways we did that. We have certain sessions that we consider more overview or introductory or big picture sessions. And we do those several times over the 24 weeks. So one is that's a great place for someone to come in and get up to speed. It's also, I think a lot of these skills are things, just like any skills, are things that take practice and you start to absorb them and really grasp them more the more times there's repetition. And so that repetition of the groups of certain sessions really helps. As I said, it's mostly experiential, not didactic. We use lots of metaphors, activities, exercises, and then link it to each person's own experiences and behaviors. There is a manual. We spent years writing and rewriting and rewriting the manual before we copyrighted it. And in fact, we're about done with the second edition of it. So we're finishing that up. There's a lot of, as I said, practice and bringing people in to talk about their own incidents that week in this new way. We talk about psychological, physical, and sexual violence. We talk about stalking behaviors. We don't shy away from those topics. We just approach them differently.
There's a rich literature on risk factors for intimate partner violence. As you know, that include low income, the stress of unemployment, aggressive personality, childhood of origin factors, alcohol and drug abuse, poor impulse control, as well as being in a high conflict relationship. So how does your program address those risk factors? Do you address them explicitly or just through the normal process of what you just discussed, the Socratic method, so to speak?
No, we address them specifically, and I think the most obvious place is in those, what I call those contributor sessions, where we talk about the different contributors to how you landed in group. And to help them sort of identify what are the contributors that are relevant to their situation, what are the things that they could change, and what are the things that can't change at this point. The other piece I think that's really worth highlighting that we would argue is markedly different from the traditional approaches is that we target the risk factors for maintenance of aggression, not onset. So for example, beliefs about sexism or growing up in this culture are factor, or family of origin violence are factors that predict who will versus who will not become violent. Mm-hmm. Now we're working with men who all have been violent already. And so the factors that predict violence onset are different than the factors that predict violence maintenance. And I think one of the faulty reasonings called the ideological treatment fallacy is that people have often said, well, if this is a cause of the onset, then we need to target it in the intervention to reduce the behaviors. And that's not necessarily true. So we identify the risk factors that predict whether someone who already has a history of violence will be violent in a given situation. And then we're targeting those risk factors.
Good point. However, as you know, not all perpetrators are the same. Some come in with a long history of chronic abuse, including power control behaviors. And some are first-time offenders or lower-level offenders who may not have such a chronic history. So how do you tailor your treatment based on those differences?
Well, so again, all of those different factors are discussed. And then we work with each person to identify what are the factors that are relevant to their situation and the pieces that they need to really be mindful of and work on. And so, as I said, for some people, it might be relationship context. For some, it might be family of origin. For some, it might be impulsivity or jealousy. For some, it might be alcohol and drugs. We don't say, we're not using a one size fits all. We're saying these are all the factors, and let's talk about in different sessions, talk about different pieces of it, you know, and then we can figure out which, you know, who are these different factors relevant for, and what are their unique challenges.
It all sounds like a very well thought out and well implemented program. So something I maybe forgot to ask you in a previous section, how did you get funding for your program? And if so, how did you get people on board? You know, given that it's kind of a new approach, and traditionally, at least my experience in the field of domestic violence, there's been a kind of resistance to deviate too far from the Duluth model or, you know, that kind of criminal justice approach.
Well, so funding, yes, we've had funding from NIMH, from the CDC, from the DOJ Office of Violence Against Women, from NICHD, some state contracts. So we've been fortunate to be able to get a lot of funding for different phases of this process. In terms of getting people on board, it really was years of really putting in the time and helping people sort of trust us. So when I started, I just joined various organizations where there were people getting together who were working on domestic violence. One of the organizations included lawyers who prosecuted these cases, Department of Corrections employees, victims advocates, police officers. And so we'd come to these meetings every week. So they started to know who I was and where I fit into this and what my views were. And I did that for about 5 years, waiting for sort of an opportunity. And then one finally came up where the Department of Corrections was going to review all of the BEPs across the state.
But what state is this?
This was in Iowa. This is where I was working at the time. And they really wanted to start to figure out a way to make sure that there was some consistency and treatment fidelity across the programs. And I was invited to be part of that project. And I sort of said, well, if you're overhauling it anyway, you know, you might, what if we tried something that might be more effective? So that started 2 years of monthly meetings. And we would drive, you know, an hour and a half each way to meet with these potential stakeholders and kind of talk about what we wanted to do and clarify some of the myths and some of their fears about what they thought we were going to do.
What were those myths? What did they think you were going to do?
That we weren't holding offenders accountable. We were being too touchy-feely. Those are the main ones. But there were a lot.
That's been my experience. You know, when I one of the reasons I've sort of been focusing more on process factors and group leadership factors and backing away from trying to compare, you know, one theoretical model versus another is because of all the politics and been trying to just find a common ground for all of us to follow a path that we can kind of agree on. And it's like if you just say that you do research, just some batter intervention providers just don't like the idea of research. They think that if you're doing research, then you're somehow trying to subvert what their initial mission is. It's been a problem. So why do you think you've been able to convince them? Do you think it was just persistence, or was it just the time was right, or?
The time was right, but we also, you know, as I said, I spent 5 years waiting for a door to open. So I was ready when one opened, and then we spent 2 years just having conversations and just I guess you could call it persistence. I would call it patience. And then once they started to say, okay, let's see what you're doing, we started to run a group. We ran one group with their facilitators. We said, come and sit in the back and observe what we're doing. Look at the sessions we've drafted. We were completely transparent. And then as they saw the change in the men in the group, and as the facilitators started to be convinced over the 24 weeks, then we started to work with them and develop groups where we worked collaboratively to revise the sessions. What do you think should be in it? You're doing this work. You're on the ground every day. What do you think is important? And so we really did it collaboratively with the communities, you know, and the people who were on the ground. And I think that was one of the big changes. We didn't come in and say, we are, you know, researchers, we're handing you a product. We said, let's build it. And I think that was, and again, took much longer that way.
Right.
And I think it was much more, we got much more buy-in, and I think it was, we got a much better product because we all worked together.
That's what is happening in California right now. There was an assembly bill that was introduced in the legislature a few years ago that would mandate that all the batterer intervention programs be evidence-based. However, some of the stakeholders, including some of the shelter people, victims advocates, were concerned about how what that would look like. And so there were discussions, and what's happening now is there's a pilot project in a couple of the counties, and they're going to see how it, they're going to look at the outcomes from that to determine how we go forward. So while some of us may want to move things forward, you know, more quickly than others, I admit that I'm kind of like that. I've been doing this for 28 years, and it wasn't until the last few years that I even heard the term evidence-based practice used by probation officers.
Mm-hmm.
So even though a lot of us would like to get things moving even more quickly, the reality is that its process probably works more like what you've discussed as just collaboration over time, patience, and so forth. So you're at a point now where you're implementing these programs. Give us a sense of what it looks like for a client to be in your program and how the program may have changed their lives. Give us some examples, obviously concealing any ones, personal identification, but give us a sense of some case studies or case examples of clients that have gone through the program, some of the fears that they may have had or challenges, and how your program may have helped them overcome some of those challenges and so forth.
I think it's really interesting because some of the men who are the most outspoken, defensive, resistant when they first come into group are the ones that have the most to say on their last night. What we would do is have them, you know, give them an opportunity to say something to the rest of the group on their last night, and how it sort of changed their life and how they really are approaching things differently. One of the things that we see over and over is that the men come in and are convinced that their behavior is automatic, that once someone, in these cases, their partner says or does something, that's it. It flips the switch and there's nothing they can do. And instead of just saying that's not true and confronting them, we really slow them down and have them notice step by step, what are the thoughts that come up, the feelings that come up. And, you know, we'll take somebody who, let's say in the first session, I remember there was somebody who refused to talk and said, I'm not doing this, I don't deserve to be here. And we said, okay, that's fine. We're going to go talk to this person over here. That's one of the benefits of an open group, is that you have some people who are new and some people who've been there a while and are starting to get on board. And so will we let him just sit there, you know, and just observe while we work with some of the other men? And then after a couple of weeks, he asked, you know, we start off the sessions that to reviewing some of the overall skills. And he asked if he could come up and diagram an incident that happened to him that week on the board, which is what we want them to do. You know, break it down into all these different pieces and what happened and what were the internal experiences and the choices you made and the values. And he just one day said, can I get up and just do this? Because I, you know, something happened to me that was really upsetting this week, and really broke it down and started to put it on the board. And it was just pretty fascinating because he came in the first day and had his arms crossed and was sitting in the corner, just, you know, trying to shoot daggers at the facilitators. And those are some of the people who come around the most profoundly. So we've also had, I'll never forget this one person who, we have a couple of sessions where we talk about mental health, depression and anxiety. As I said, we also talk about substance use. I do not claim that we're treating those in these sessions. We were not, but we sort of do an awareness and an education about it, and then encourage people for whom it's relevant to get treatment. And help them connect to resources. And there was one man in the group who really had never said much. And we got to the session where we were talking about depression and anxiety, and he started to cry and said he had never realized he actually was profoundly depressed, and felt really alone. And just that was the first time he'd really been aware of that. And that's, again, not excusing his violence in any way, but that was another piece of, you know, what was going on with him that needed to be dealt with. And the men were very supportive in the group and sort of came over and said, look, if you're really down and you need to call me, or, you know, if you need a ride, like, And he went and got, at the same time, we got him connected to resources where he could get help for his depression at the same time. And I just think those are stories that we don't think of. Those of us, people who don't work with this population, you know, think of them all as that they don't value respect or relationships, or they might not cry in session. And we really see these human sides of them.
With this particular client, Erica, how did you help him see the relation, help to make a connection between his feeling depressed and being violent? Did you discuss any of that at all?
We did not. Yeah. No, I think the goal in that session was to get him connected to help for the depression. But what happened then is that, I mean, I think to make that link again in that moment would not have been that not productive toward at least my goal, which was to get him connected to help.
Right.
What happened as a result, though, is that he was much more open and participated a lot more in sessions after that. And so really started to talk about different incidents and different events and how he had behaved and really own his behavior and ask questions and really try to struggle with how to change his behavior and practice new strategies. So I think it just opened up his willingness to be accountable and to change his behavior.
Overall, what do clients tell you is the most effective part of the program? I think I read in an article either by yourself or Amy Zarling, I think that at least one of your studies found that detaching was really important component. But I'm not sure if that's what you found to be objectively true or what clients said worked for them. But what do clients tell you work best about the program? You know, you have these end of program meetings what do they identify as being helpful to them?
The thing I hear the most is, and yeah, some of them may be using the word detaching, this idea of being able to step back and notice their thoughts and feelings as, or let's say we take thoughts, as thoughts that your mind is generating as opposed to literal truths or facts or reality. Or their feelings as feelings. They don't have to run from them or be afraid of them or try to control them. And so noticing their thoughts and feelings and stepping back from them, we call this self as context, was really one of the biggest things because it allowed them to slow down in the moment. That's the piece I hear over and over. They came in and were just convinced that their behavior was automatic and they were flipping a switch and there was nothing that could be done. And by the end, they were saying, no, I can really slow down in that moment and notice how angry I am and notice the thoughts that are coming up and notice my urge to be aggressive in some cases. And then think about what are my values in this moment? What really matters to me? What can I do that would move me toward that value? And then do it. Now, again, we're talking about 6 months. But the fact that they came in and said, this is not possible. And in the end, they're describing events where they actually are doing that and really changing their behavior, I think, to me, is the most common thing that the men say they got out of it.
And they feel more in control of their lives. And what role does meditation play, especially mindfulness meditation play in your program? I assume it's a big part of it.
Not meditation per se. Again, I think that's complementary and certainly consistent with ACT or mindfulness work. Mindfulness is one of the six processes involved in ACT. And so while we're not doing meditation per se, I think it's very consistent with that. We certainly teach things like grounding yourself, which would be consistent with that. And noticing the thoughts and feelings internally, but then bringing yourself into the room and helping people be in the present moment. So that's something that we practice a lot. And for some people, that's really helpful.
I should clarify by saying that when I mention meditation, I'm really thinking of the grounding type of meditation, right? Not necessarily transcendental meditation or formal systems like that. But,
so this is one of the six processes. We definitely teach them to do some of that mindfulness and how to be in the present and practice that over and over again, even while there are thoughts and feelings and internal experiences swirling inside.
For a long time, especially the first 10 years, my program, I kind of resisted doing a lot of that kind of work. And one of the reasons was that I had a lot of resistance to it. from my clients, and we tried to do meditation exercises, and they thought it was, hippie dippy kind of stuff. And but I found that when I started pressing them, we just made it a point to do a grounding meditation, a short grounding meditation. We just made it a part of our curriculum, that they came on board. And as a matter of fact, now if we go a week without doing an exercise, then the clients actually feel ripped off. They want to do it. Let me ask you to tell us a little bit about how providers like ourselves and others could get access to your materials and or training. How would they contact you?
They could just reach out to me, email or phone. And we definitely, as I said, we have a number of different states or counties that we work with and are, get funding to do implementation studies or effectiveness studies or to help sort of curb some of the costs. But yes, I mean, we offer at this point, we still offer the manual for free. We can come in and do the training. We also have a train the trainer model so that we can train you so that you can make it sustainable over time.
Is there a cost for that?
If you're bringing us in for training, just for our time and any travel expenses, but so we're not charging for the cost of the manual, and we work again with each place and what's feasible and what we can make happen so that it works for them, and then over time they can train the we have people that become trainers, certified trainers, and then they can train their own people. And it's fully sustainable without us, which I think is the point.
So if someone wanted to contact you either to obtain your manual and or to get training, is there a website they can go to or an email address?
We don't have a specific website for that, although we're working on that. But certainly they could reach out to me over email, which is E Lawrence, ELAWRENCE, E Lawrence at family-institute.org. And then we can get them, whatever they would like. I can also give you my office number, which is 847-733-4300, extension 880.
Fantastic. I really appreciate your time, Erica. This is our first podcast that's a two-parter, and I thought we
Oh.
would need an extended amount of time to discuss what I think is one of the most promising new approaches to, like you call, third wave approaches to batter intervention. And I do appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much.